Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Happy Monday, August 18th. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. We had a great weekend in Seattle. I got to tell you about that in just a second. A couple things we're going to talk about this hour. The news release that Rick Warren sent out, which I have here, and which is how McCain and Obama were informed of what were going to be the topics of discussion, seems to have a rather startling disconnect from what actually happened at, Saddleback Church over the weekend. And so I want to share that with you. There's a fascinating piece over at the Asia Times right now talking about what's going on in the Ukraine and the Russian perspective on what's going on. Medvedev has just come out and said basically, well, the headlines from Times Online, cross us and we will crush you. And so, you know, everything is amping up. But we had for the weekend, Louise and I took the train up to Seattle on Saturday afternoon. And Saturday, we got there at 4. The gig starts at 5. At 4:30, we meet out in front of the hotel with Mike Malloy and Randy Rhodes and Stephanie Miller and Sam Cedar and Ron Reagan narrated. He was there, but he wasn't in the car with us. And so here we are. We get into this SUV with this Russian driver who speaks very little English. I was tempted to say, «Здравствуйте, товарищ!» throw some Russian at him. But I very quickly figured out that it would be a bad idea to try to throw any Russian at this guy. He pulls away from the hotel, and the street we're on is First Avenue. It's going south. Where we need to be is about 8 blocks north and a couple blocks, I think, east or west or whatever. We need to go 8 blocks north and a block or so off. And he starts going south. And he drives for like 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And we're just like wandering out, you know, and finally Sam in the back, you know, thank God for Sam. Sam in the back pulls out his iPhone and does the map thing on it and says, I think we're going the wrong direction. And the guy in the front, so Stephanie Miller is in the front, who's wearing the shortest skirt I've ever seen with fishnet stockings. And she said she claimed she had to do it to compete with all the brains in the car. She made that point to 1,400 people Saturday night. Anyway, Stephanie, so Stephanie's like, do you know where you're going? He's like, no, I don't know. They didn't tell me where to go. This is 15 minutes into the ride. We've got to be there in 15 minutes, right? So at that point, we finally, Malloy in the back is going, where did you learn how to drive? Oh my God! He's in full Malloyed mode, which is just further angering the driver. The driver's just like, you know, really starting to lose it. But it was also getting his attention. And so the driver makes a right at all of our insistence, but we really needed to go left. We were on first. We needed to go left up to third, you know, or up to fourth because the meeting was on third. But anyhow, he makes a right and gets us down on the waterfront. And we're all the way down on the waterfront. And the city of Seattle is now like climbing up this hill. There's no right turns you can take. And we're stuck in this huge traffic jam because all these people are going to see the Bears play the Seahawks. There's this huge game that starts in 25 minutes. And, you know, we're debating whether we should get him to do a U-turn because there's no traffic going the other way, but we're going in the right direction. So Sam is doing his GPS thing. It was, and at that point, because all we could see was water. I mean, we were alongside the water, and Randy's like, ah, well, we can swim to the event. And, yeah, because we were heading out towards the islands. And I was keeping in touch with Paul Fredericks, the grand poobah at Talk 1090, and the 1,400 people who were waiting for us. But we made it. Felt like kissing the ground. And the driver's now in therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder from Mike Malloy. And by the way, the one thing we forgot Saturday night, all of us actually forgot to say, and should have been said to the folks at Talk 1090 was thank you. This was an incredible gig. 1,400 people paid $25 a piece to show up and listen to us for 3 hours rant and rave. We had a great time, or at least I had a great time. I think I can speak for everybody. And so Paul, Holiday, all the great folks at Talk 1090 in Seattle, thank you. And if you're a listener in Seattle, call the station and let them know how much you appreciate it, because we didn't have an opportunity to express that and really should have. Now, back to Brokeback Church, Saddleback Church, excuse me. I have a news release here in my hand to political editors, dated Monday, July 21st, 5 a.m., dropped into PR Newswire and U.S. Newswire. These are news services where you drop a news release in and they distribute them out. Dateline Lake Forest, California. Senator John McCain and Barack Obama, respective, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. They're going to come to the Saddleback Church on Saturday, August, and blah, blah. Rick Warren is quoted in the news release. He says, "We're honored that the candidates chose the Saddleback Civil Forum on Leadership and Compassion for their first joint appearance, an unprecedented opportunity for America to hear both men back-to-back on the same platform." And he continues, "This is a critical time for our nation, and the American people deserve to hear both candidates speak from the heart, without interruption, in a civil and thoughtful format, absent the partisan gotcha questions that typically produce heat instead of light. I will be raising questions in four areas beyond what political reporters typically ask. This includes pressing issues," and then he lists the four areas. "This includes pressing issues that are bridging divides in our nation, such as poverty, HIV/AIDS, climate, and human rights." So Barack Obama came all prepped to answer questions about poverty and climate change and human rights and HIV/AIDS, and got asked questions about Supreme Court and abortion. And this is after Warren says none of the hot button issues with this is not going to be a litmus test. In fact, he goes on to say in this press release, this lying press release, From Rick Warren at Saddleback Church. He says, "Since the oath of the president is a commitment to protect the Constitution, it's critical to know how each candidate interprets the nature of its principles." Its principles like, you know, maybe habeas corpus. I just find this mind-boggling, frankly. Mind-boggling. Not to mention the fact that it's pretty clear that while John McCain didn't hear what went on, and in fact, it would have been stupid for him. He was not, by the way, in the cone of silence. Rick Warren gets up and he says, "John McCain's in a cone of silence." He was lying, and he knew he was lying when he said it, because John McCain was in his limousine on his way there. Now, there was some speculation, there's been some speculation in the media that McCain, being in his limousine instead of in his cone of silence, was listening to the debates. He certainly seemed to know what was going to be asked. He certainly seemed to have stories, anecdotes, and short, pithy answers pre-prepared for what was asked. In fact, at one point, he was even, "When are we going to get to the question about the Supreme Court justices?" Even though he was asked a question about abortion. And he says, you know, because if you're going to talk about abortion, you got to talk about the Supreme Court. I don't think that he was listening. I don't think they were playing XM in the limousine. I think instead that his aide sitting next to him was listening with an earphone and was saying to McCain, "Get ready. I want to know the story about the guy with the, who drew the cross in the sand, about your POW time," which, by the way, is a story that McCain was not telling years ago, never told initially after he left Vietnam, and seems to only have been telling since he read it in a Solzhenitsyn novel. Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote the story of, you know, this, I mean, this is right out of Gulag Archipelago, or however you say it, the great Gulag story, where he says, it was Christmas Day, and we were allowed to stand outside our cell for a few minutes. In those days, we were not allowed to see or communicate with each other. This is McCain. Well, here's Solzhenitsyn. And he's saying essentially the exact same thing. I will share it with you right after this break. And it is really, really quite astounding. It also looks like, you know, McCain also cited the story of the Down syndrome women being fitted with blow up vests to go into Iraq. Turns out that's an urban legend, too, at least according to the military. McCain quoting this. Bottom line, facts don't matter for the McCain campaign, just sound bites.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
And I'll tell you true, Barack Obama don't like the Jews. He's a Muslim, a terrorist freak. Even if he's in church every week, we're swift voting to affect the voting. No sugar coating, we ain't joking, we're swift voting. He'll make this country a hippie commune, running on fried grease and methane fumes. Make your children learn Spanish too. Make your mama eat Muslim food with swift voting. Defect the voting. From Minnesotans to North Dakotans, dig the swift voting.
22 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. No, I don't think so. Oh, boy. Along with other prisoners, he worked in the fields day after day in rain and sun during summer and winter. His life appeared to be nothing more than backbreaking labor and slow starvation. The intense suffering reduced him to a state of despair. On one particular day, the hopelessness of his situation became too much for him. He saw no reason to continue his struggle, no reason to keep on living. His life made no difference in the world, so he gave up. Leaving his shovel on the ground, he slowly walked to a crude bench and sat down. He knew that at any moment a guard would order him to stand up, and when he failed to respond, the guard would beat him to death, probably with his own shovel. He'd seen it happen to other prisoners. As he waited, head down, he felt a presence. Slowly he looked up and saw a skinny, old prisoner squat down beside him. The man said nothing. Instead, he used a stick to trace in the dirt the sign of the cross. The man then got up and returned to his work. As Solzhenitsyn stared at the cross drawn in the dirt, his entire perspective changed. He knew that there was only one man, that he was only one man against the all-powerful Soviet Empire, yet he knew there was something greater than the evil he saw in the prison camp, something greater than the Soviet Union. He knew that hope for all people was represented by that simple cross. Through the power of the cross, anything was possible. Solzhenitsyn slowly rose to his feet, picked up his shovel, and went back to work. Outwardly, nothing had changed. Inside, he had received hope. From Luke Voronis, The Sign of the Cross, published in Communion Magazine, Pashka, Issue 8, Pashka, 1997. And interestingly, John McCain's The Prisoner story, you know, he was a prisoner and the guard came and with his sandal drew the sign of the cross. Back 5 years ago when John McCain was telling this story, he was telling it about another prisoner. He wasn't telling it about himself. The story has morphed over the years. Well, you know, when Joe Biden used a phrase that somebody else, another politician, had used in a speech. used it four or five times, and attributed the other politician the first four or five times he used it. The last time he used it, he didn't. And it was used to take him down in the presidential primaries back, 12 years ago, I think this was. He was called a plagiarist and all this. I mean, it was all blown out of proportion. And in fact, I think Joe Biden would make a great vice president. He's my number one pick for vice president. But anyhow, Biden was accused of plagiarism for something that was much less, irrelevant compared to this. It had nothing to do with his biography. It had nothing to do with this being a prisoner of war. I think that actually the time has come. Plisko has a piece over at YouTube. Well, I'll have to grab this thing and put it on our website. The video challenging John McCain as a war hero. John McCain graduated at the bottom of his class in the Naval Academy. It was his family connections that got him a command position in the Navy, where he became known as a party boy. This is what Roy is sharing in his video. While training in the Navy, his planes crashed twice and once collided with power lines. He was an incompetent pilot. As a combat pilot, he failed to act on a missile alert, and his plane got hit. A bad ejection led to injuries, which led to him being captured. Family connections helped him again. He was treated better than other detainees. He wasn't punished as much as other prisoners because he gave propaganda to the enemy. 4 days after his capture, he signed a confession. He did radio and TV appearances. He starred in more than 30 propaganda films. Over at military.com right now, one of the other guys who was in the prisoner of war camps with John McCain is saying, sorry, I'm not going to vote for this guy. Later, McCain committed adultery, divorced his wife, who was injured in a car accident, married a younger, rich woman. And then as a public servant, got himself up to his neck in one of the biggest bank scandals in history. This Roy's narrative for this YouTube video. Now, there's another politician whose wife was severely injured in a car accident. In fact, she died along with his infant daughter. That was Joe Biden. He was sworn in. Carl Wilson told me this morning. Carl does the morning show on KPIJ. Carl is such a political scholar. 1972, Joe Biden was sworn in to his office by the bedside of his two boys who had survived the car crash. He didn't remarry for 5 years. So his wife got in a car crash, but instead of, immediately having an affair, as John McCain did, in fact, John McCain got his marriage license to Cindy while he was still married to Carol, his first wife, who was disfigured in this car accident. Instead, Joe Biden waited 5 years until he married Jane, his second wife, raising his two boys after his wife and his infant daughter had died in the car crash. I think that there's some parallels to be drawn here. I don't think the Obama campaign will do it, but somebody should.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at
866-303-2270. I'm telling you, Rick Warren over at Brokeback Mountain Church set this thing up so that John McCain's 527s could knock it out of the park. First of all, he did not ask the questions that he said he was going to ask in the beginning. Secondly, John McCain was not in a cone of silence, and Rick Warren lied about it. He later sort of came clean on CNN, but I thought it was pretty weaselly. And third, now we see that Pat Buchanan is saying, this is a quote from Pat Buchanan. I do know Republicans are planning, or rather 527s are planning attack ads on this issue. And I will be interested to see if Rick Warren brings it up. What's this issue? This is Pat Buchanan's phrase. Most important, Barack Obama and the Illinois legislature supported, or rather opposed, a bill that would have protected the life of babies born from a botched abortion who were alive three times. Now, in fact, what happened was there was a piece of legislation before the Illinois legislature that did say if a baby is born alive as a result of a botched abortion, you have to try to save the life of that baby. And when federal legislation came along that's just said that, Barack Obama actually supported it. But the state legislation was worded in such a way that that secondary to that argument about saving the baby, it redefined all fetuses as babies. In other words, it would have outlawed abortion. It was a backdoor way of outlawing abortion. This from an Associated Press story, January 17th, 2007. The headline, Obama Record May Be Goldmine for Critics. Abortion opponents see Obama's vote on medical care for aborted fetuses as a refusal to protect the helpless. Some have even accused him of supporting infanticide. I'm telling you, that's going to be the swift boat that is going to really sting. That these guys are preparing to, just like they called John Kerry, he said he wasn't a war hero. They're going to call Barack Obama a guy who's in favor of infanticide, killing children, killing infants. Obama, and this back to the AP story, Obama, who joined several other Democrats in voting present in 2001 and no in the next year, 2002, argued the legislation was worded in a way that unconstitutionally threatened a woman's right to abortion by defining the fetus as a child. And then they quote Obama. This is his own words. He said that legislation would essentially bar all abortions because the Equal Protection Clause does not allow somebody to kill a child. And if this was a child, then this would be an anti-abortion statute or law. So that's why he voted against it, because the language of the bill, I mean, the bill's intent to save the life of a baby that's born after a botched abortion, you know, I think it's something that probably most Americans would support, and Barack Obama supported at the federal level. But the language in the bill that would essentially ban all abortions, you know, he couldn't go along with that. And they are planning ads now claiming that he is in favor of infanticide. Mark my words. Mark my words. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Michael in Long Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michael, you think McCain won the debate?
Oh, yeah, obviously he did.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, first of all, it wasn't a debate, but I think that McCain won more out of this than Obama did in my home.
Yeah, I think what happened, Tom, is that, you know, when they accuse, like Andrea Mitchell came on and said that McCain was privy to all the questions, I mean, that's insult to McCain's integrity. He, you know, I think that when you lose in a situation, you make it.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about the integrity of the McCain who's running ads right now that are lying about Barack Obama's voting record, that are lying and claiming that he voted to raise taxes on people earning $47,000 a year, on the McCain who apparently is making up stories, is plagiarizing from Alexander Solzhenitsyn about stories of being a prisoner of war? I mean, this McCain, who has flip-flopped on virtually every major issue, you're concerned about his integrity?
When you put it that way, okay. But the point is,
this guy will do or say anything to win, including lying. And as I said in the beginning, I don't think he listened to it, because then he could slip up. He could use a phrase. But I think the guy sitting next to him was listening to it and was telling him, okay, Senator, get ready for this. Okay, Senator, I think the guy sitting next to him was rephrasing the questions in a way that helped McCain, because McCain came out loaded for bear, totally prepped. Barack Obama walked into and the other problem, of course, is that Barack Obama pulled a John Kerry. He gave thoughtful, intelligent answers. And in America today, and particularly in front of an evangelical church, thoughtful, intelligent, insightful answers are not what plays. People want bumper stickers. People want slogans. And, you know, it's Tom in Los Angeles. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. I love your show, first off. And
thanks.
I just wanted to say, cracking the code, because I know that you are very, you know, much for the terms that we use and the words that we use. And one of the things that I noticed, even I noticed yourself doing it last week, which is calling it the abortion issue. And it's not the abortion issue. It's the one thing Bill Clinton framed very well. He called it the woman's right to choose issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, as Democrats and as the media and everyone, we have fallen into this trap of calling it either the abortion issue or pro-life issue. Whereas I myself am a Catholic, as a person that's also a Democrat, but I'm a person that believes in pro-life all the way across the board. I personally don't believe in abortion, but I believe it's a woman's right to choose.
But see, this is where Obama was, you know, he had such an opportunity when Rick Warren asked him about that, and he said, it's above my pay grade. And, you know, Warren set the question. He established the frame by saying, since Roe v. Wade, there have been 40 million abortions, isn't that a Holocaust? I mean, or he asserted that that's a Holocaust. If he had said that to me, my response would have been, you know, before Roe v. Wade, there were 40 million abortions.
But
they were just being done illegally. They were, you know, and wealthy women were getting what were called DNC, dilation and whatever it is, you know, where they open the uterus and scrape it out. And it was because they were having hard menstrual periods. That was, I'm old enough to remember, you know, friends of mine to whom that happened. And if you had the money to get it, you know, to get a doctor to do that, that was how abortions were performed legally. And then illegally, abortions were performed dozens of different ways that very often left women dead. But, you know, the number of abortions performed, you know, may have increased slightly as a result of decriminalizing abortions, might have even increased significantly. But the fact of the matter is that if you want to drop the number of abortions, drop the number of pregnancies.
See, Tom, I agree with you, but again, if we're getting back to bumper sticker type issues and things like that, I mean, we're framing it right away even when we call it the abortion issue. It's a woman's right to choose issue. And just like anyone can bear arms.
Right, but I get your point on the language, but at a certain point, Americans get it that this is really about a woman's right to choose an abortion.
I just know that Bill Clinton never, ever used the words abortion. He never got pro-life, pro-choice in there. He just always talked about a woman's right to choose. He kept using that whenever he spoke at the Democratic Convention when he was, you know, elected. I mean, instead of us getting caught up in all this stuff, if you wanted to get women around you on your side, you know, it's their choice. We can't tell women how to run their body.
Yeah. Good point, Tom. Thank you very much for making it. And I will make an effort, although I'm sure it'll be imperfect, to remain in that frame, and hopefully our politicians will as well. Len in New York. Hey, Len.
Hi. You know, abortion's been my issue for years and years, since my first debate in high school. And I didn't call about that, but to me, I try to point out simply to someone, who are you outlawing abortion for? Because a woman who lives in a 10-bedroom home can get on a plane and go have an abortion, but her maid can't. So all you're doing is punishing the poor, just like any other.
Well, it goes beyond that. If men could get pregnant, abortion would become a sacrament. It wouldn't just be legal. And you know, frankly, I think that men should not be allowed to vote on this issue or speak on it.
I think it just has to be someone else, a person's own choice. But
yeah.
I called because, you know, everybody who I was listening to thought the most poignant aspect of McCain's performance was his whole war issue. You know, his war background, his prisoner of war status.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there's a simple response that really we have to just embrace. And that is that America, other democracies, and even dictatorships do not award presidencies for war service. They award medals.
Right, although the fact of the matter is, Len, that at least three times in the history of this nation, four times, you think of Teddy Roosevelt, USS Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, Dwight Eisenhower.
They gave them the job because of the person,
old Hickory.
Because of their war service. I'm not arguing that war service doesn't matter. I'm just saying that you know, war service is only an aspect, and we don't award it simply for war service.
And that was the point that Wesley Clark was making when he said, you know, just being a prisoner of war doesn't qualify you to be president. Wesley Clark, by the way, who apparently is not showing up at the Democratic National Convention, which has got me scratching my head. What's the deal with that? Ron in San Francisco. Hey, Ron.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I have a statement to make, and then I'll explain it real quick. Republicans believe the ends justify the means.
Yes, the point that I made Saturday night in Seattle.
Democrats believe how you get there is as important as where you wind up.
Yep.
That is why no one from the Democratic side is going to be swift voting John McCain. Let me tell you, if John McCain was a Democrat and there was as much information, as much footage, and as much material that could discount almost everything.
His making 30 war propaganda films for the North Vietnamese in exchange for better treatment in the prisoner of war camp. Can you imagine if John Kerry had done that?
Yes, exactly. And let me tell you, if John McCain was a Democrat, that film footage, which is available, would be in ads running.
And they'd be calling him Hanoi John, and they'd have him right there with Miss Fonda, you know, Jane Fonda. I mean, it's just yes, absolutely, Ron. And this is the point. You know, the question was asked Saturday night at this forum that we did in Seattle. Why is it that the Republicans are willing to lie and the Democrats don't? And I said it's because the Republicans believe in the divine lie, in the appropriate lie, because they believe that the ends justify the means. And it's a disaster.
This is The Moment. Continuing live coverage from Denver of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell. Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam. Roberts is supreme. My revenge for Bork. Someone's in removing some brush.
51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at teamster.org. And by the way, coming up next week, I'll be in Denver, Colorado, and giving a talk and signing books. I believe that's Tuesday night, the 26th. That's a Tuesday, right? August 26th at 6 p.m. at Borders Books in Lone Tree, Colorado. And so you can, you know, be sure to show up there and say hi. We should have a great time that Tuesday night. And then the following week, on September 2nd, which I believe is also a Tuesday, AM 950, The Voice of Minnesota, our affiliate there, 950 KTNF, invites you to a party for change. It'll be Stephanie Miller, me, Jim Ward, Ed Schultz, Chris Lavoie, John Elliott, Bill Press, if I didn't already say that. And Bill and I, in fact, Bill Press and I are going to be doing a book signing at 5:30. Party runs until 9 o'clock. It's at the Black Bear Crossing on the lake, and the tickets are $10. So just a heads up on that. Henry in Rochester, New York. Hey, Henry, welcome to the show.
Man, I tell you what, that's going to be a hell of an event with all y'all together, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a wild time last night, too. Oh, and one of our listeners in Seattle wrote to say, I thought the event started on time. It actually did. What we were late for was a meet and greet with the advertisers, which was supposed to run for an hour before that. But in any case, I thought it was a really good entourage. You know, we should turn this thing into a road show.
I heard that. I sure wish I could have been there.
Yeah, it was fun. So what's up?
My thing is this, on two deals about the McCain deal. First of all, you know, when he came out and everything, right before the questions going to do, when he started answering the questions, it's like he already knew the questions that was going to happen. And he already, like, rehearsed his lines about what he's about to say. Because for McCain, for a guy who keeps forgetting names and things like that in speeches, all of a sudden, you tell me he remembers everything to the exact moment? Oh,
yeah.
Come on, man. You know, give me a break. I knew something was up.
Yeah.
And I love the answer that McCain gave when they asked him about Supreme Court justices, how all of a sudden he wanted to get rid of everybody that's non-Republican on the Supreme Court.
Actually, three of the four are Republicans. They're just not right-wing Republicans.
Well,
you know, David Souter was appointed by his dad. You know, it's a... but yeah, you're excellent point, Henry. Excellent point. Oh, and I should add, by the way, last night in Seattle, Rachel Maddow was there too. She just wasn't in the car with us because she has family there and she was visiting with them. But it was really great to see Rachel again. In fact, afterwards we went back to the bar at the hotel, and Rachel is a master drink maker and was supervising the production of alcoholic beverages. It was a marvelous time. Mark in Framingham, Mass.
Yes. Hi. The one takeaway I got from Saturday was that John is big about being committed to a higher purpose, and he said that he committed himself when he swore his oath as a midshipman to doing his best for his country. And it turns out his best for that first 4 years was 893 out of 899. I got to guess a few of those midshipmen were just coasting. So if John can't even be the regular coasting midshipman, I think that might have something to do with his problem flying the plane.
Yeah, he at the bottom of the class. I mean, it's George Bush revisited. You know, he was known as a party animal. He was into drinking and chasing women. He was having an incredibly hot-headed temper.
But he's asserting we should vote for him because he committed to doing his best when he joined the academy. And after the commitment, that was his follow-up on his commitment made then.
Yeah, but the problem is, here's the problem, Mike, is reality doesn't matter. It's the perception of reality. And John McCain and his campaign are doing a very good job of crafting the perception of reality of him as somebody other than the historical record indicates he is, and of Barack Obama also being somebody other than the historical record characterizes him as, and that's a problem. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Lorenzo in Sandusky, Ohio. Hey, Lorenzo.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. What's up?
I'm a huge Barack fan, of course. And our local neighborhood, in the barbershop, we know McCain is not a good candidate, but he's definitely making Barack seem very wimpish, and he's walking all over him. And Barack needs to get a backbone because he's, even though we're going to vote for him, he's coming across as very wimpish in our eyes.
Yeah.
McCain's campaign, since he brought home Carl Rhodes Jr., is definitely more aggressive, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to win. And if Barack is going to keep his head above the clouds like he's acting, he's not going to win. He needs to get down there and fight and stop acting like such a wimp.
Yeah, he needs to take names and kick ass. Absolutely, Lorenzo. I totally agree with you. And in fact, I would even take it a step beyond that. This weekend, I was watching either Face the Nation or Meet the Press. I forget which one it was. And Tim Kaine, the Democrat, the governor, and Bobby Jindal were on. And Jindal, of course, the guy who got an exorcism for his girlfriend once, a strange story. But in any case, Jindal goes into this whole rant about how McCain wants to raise taxes on people making more than $47,000 a year. And it's a lie. I mean, it's just a lie. Jindal, actually, that was one of several lies that he told. And Kaine never, you know, the guy who was the surrogate for Obama, the spokesman for Obama, never interrupted him. Never said a word about, I'm sitting there going, you know, stop this. And of course, the you know, I believe it was David Gregory, the host, of course, never said, hey, well, you know, excuse me, I'm a newsman. I know that's a lie. But no, they just let them get away with it. 57 minutes past the hour. Michelle Bernard is up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Michelle Bernard is the author of Women's Progress, How Women Are Healthier, Wealthier, Healthier, and More Independent Than Ever Before. She's the president and chief executive officer of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, an organization that in 1992 grew out of the ad hoc group Women for Judge Thomas. And she's also a political analyst for MSNBC and the Women's Independent Voice, also another associated forum. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
You wrote a piece, news and commentary, over and our listeners can find it over at IWF.org, called Saving the Planet While Letting the Children Starve. And it starts out with what seems to me like a really confusing or perhaps even false syllogism. You say a certain moral vanity infuses the environmental movement. It demands drastic action to prevent possible warming a century away, but offers little or no hope to those starving or dying of AIDS today. Why did you frame it that way? I don't get it.
Well, I think it's pretty clear. You know, if you take a look at any ad that you see in the newspaper or in a magazine, or you take a look at commercials, or you look at anything that's put out in writing by most environmentalists today, there's this culture of people who care more about trees than they do about human beings. And so I thought that sentence makes it pretty clear. You've got
First of all, the environmental movement is not the AIDS movement.
No, it's not the AIDS movement.
By accusing the environmental movement of not being the AIDS movement, I don't see how that scores you any points. And secondly, I don't know anybody who cares more about trees than about people. The argument that the environmental movement makes is just like your body needs both your kidneys and your liver. That the earth is a living organism. It is a whole thing, and all of these different forms of life on this planet are part of an interrelated web of life. And when the complexity of that web of life is reduced beyond a certain critical threshold, the entire system begins to crash. Just like, you know, you can get by with one kidney, but if you lose two, you're toast.
Well, I mean, that's true. That is what they argue, and what I argue
is also true biologically.
Biologically, it is true, but what I argue in this piece, Tom, is that if you take a look at all of the scientists, not just one or two, but all of the scientists who are having this debate over climate change, whether or not it is caused by man, and whether or not climate change can effectively be dealt with, and whether or not the planet is warming or cooling, and history teaches us that the Earth goes through periods of time where the Earth warms, and periods of time where the Earth cools. One of the things that I would pose is that we need to be asking ourselves, as part of the global community, if worrying so much about global warming, which may or may not ever occur, is more important than worrying about things like AIDS and malaria and people who are dying and starving in poverty.
Well, I would say, first of all, why can't we do something about both? And number two, there is no debate among real scientists. I know that there's a bunch of shills out there paid off by the oil companies and some of the large right-wing foundations that also support the Independent Women's Forum that are trying to suggest that there's a debate. But IPCC conclusions have been the National Academy of Sciences of Brazil, the Academia Brasilia de Ciências, the Royal Society of Canada, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the French, the Académie des Sciences Françaises, the Deutsche Akademie der Naturwissenschaften, the German Academy of Sciences, the Indian National Academy of Sciences, the Italian, the Accademia dei Lincei, the Italian National Academy of Sciences, the Science Council of Japan, the Russian Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society of the United Kingdom, the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, the Australian Academy. I mean, this is 10% of the list of the people who have signed on with the IPCC and all of the world's leading scientists to say not only is global warming happening, but when we pass the 350 parts per million threshold of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere about a half a decade ago, we're at 385 right now. We, as James Hansen said in this recent piece where he said, if there's no activity before 2012, that's too late. What we do in the next two or three years will determine our future. This is the defining moment. He made the point that civilization literally is at a tipping point. This is a quote from his piece. He said, if humanity wishes to preserve a planet similar to that on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, paleoclimatological evidence and ongoing climate change suggest the CO2 will need to be reduced from its current 385 ppm to at most 350 ppm. I mean, that's the consensus.
Now, well, that's what you say the consensus is, but one of the things I have to ask you is, any scientist who disagrees with the consensus or what we're told conventional wisdom tells us about gets eaten alive. Nobody is looking at the hard facts and the hard scientists. What do you do about all of the studies that have shown that the Earth typically goes through periods of warming and cooling? Back in the 1970s, we were told that the Earth was going through a period of cooling and we were all going to freeze to death. Now we're being told that we're all going to burn up to death if we don't go back to the time of the horse and buggy.
No, we're not being told that either. We're being told that we're looking at massive changes in climate. And yes, there are 12,000-year cycles, 36,000-year cycles, 100-and-some-odd-thousand-year cycles. All of that stuff is factored in the equation. The question is anthropogenic warming, human-caused warming. And there's an absolute consensus among scientists around the world that humans are increasing the temperature of the planet and that it's happening because of greenhouse gases that are largely caused by burning oil and coal. And
so
you've got
what
the coal
then do
and
you
oil
do,
industries.
Tom? Tom, so then what do we do about countries like India and China and all of the other emerging nations around the world who want to get to a point in their development where they live like the way that we do in the United States of America? Do we just tell them, hey, sorry, stay in poverty, back off, don't do any more research and development, don't consume any more energy, because here at home we're going to continue to burn oil and we're going to continue to live the kind of way that we've lived, because that's what's going to happen.
Michelle, we provide them.
Most Americans are not going to stop driving their cars, and ethanol, there will never be enough ethanol to fuel the way that we live.
I agree. We're talking with Michelle Bernard. She's the president of the Independence Women's Forum, IWF.org. Michelle, what we do is the exact same thing we did in the late 19th century. We provide them with an example. The industrial machinery during the peak of the Industrial Revolution from the 1880s to the 1910 period in all of Europe was driven by wood. It was all steam. Everything was steam. It was driven by wood. And when Colonel Drake in 1865 drilled the first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and then John Rockefeller really started ginning that stuff up, and we started refining it into kerosene, and we started using it as a source of fuel, and the United States came up with a new energy source. After 7,000 years of civilization being fueled by wood, we said, no, we're going to use oil. And then the rest of the world began to imitate us. If we want India and China to move off of oil and stop destroying our environment, or stop the risk of destroying not just our environment, but all human life, then let's provide them with a model. We consume a quarter of the world's oil, even though we're only 5% of the world's population. Let's develop solar and wind technologies, geothermal, which works. I mean, all of Iceland is 100% now off all foreign oil, you know. Let's develop these technologies here and show the world how to do it. And in the process, make millions and billions of dollars.
Well, can you tell me of one society where wind and solar actually do it?
Yeah, in Denmark, I did my show from Denmark about a month and a half ago. We had the former prime minister on. We had several members of the parliament on. They're up to 19% of all their electricity is being produced by wind right now. They are, within the next 5 years, they're manufacturing within the country electric cars that are going to act as a giant battery system. The big problem they have is at night these windmills are blowing. They could be producing 50% of the country's energy. These windmills are blowing at night, and the electricity's got no place to go. And so they're providing tax incentives and for the individuals and for the industry, because it's cheaper than building another nuclear power plant. And all across the country, people are going to have electric cars that at night they will plug in and they will charge. And then during the daytime, they drive the car to work and they plug it in again, and then they sell back that electricity to the utility. You discharge your car during the day and you're buying electricity at 2 cents a watt at night, and you're selling it at 5 cents a watt during the day. You can actually make a profit with your car.
Look, I am not averse by any stretch of the imagination to new technology. I think that that is what drives our global economy. I mean, I do have to play a devil's advocate, though, and ask, like when you were in Denmark, if you got to ask them, what happens on days when there's just no wind? What do you do? Does everybody sit in the dark all day long?
Well, actually, there are very few days when there's not that much wind, but they also are connected with a grid with Germany, which is now producing about almost 20% of its electricity through solar. And so there's solar power. I don't know if they're doing much with geothermal. You got Norway, which has got an enormous amount of water power. Norway used to sell electricity to Denmark. Now it's the other way around. Denmark is selling wind power to Norway. You do it, you know, kind of the T. Boone Pickens way. You know, let's put all this stuff together.
Anyway. I like T. Boone Pickens, but I disagree with him on this.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's an interesting discussion. You can read Michelle Bernard's piece, Saving the Planet While Letting Children Starve. It's over at IWF.org. Michelle Bernard, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you.
It's great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Comes a calling as it might for you or me. I ran into to my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I'm Martin here with you, and time for a pigeon alert.
Farmer had raised chickens since he was 24, all working for the colonel for 30 years or more, killing all the chickens and sending them to fry. Now it's payback time for ghost chickens in the sky.
Yes. Well, pigeons come in many shades in New York City, but purple is typically not one of them. As the Associated Press, that's why animal lover Joe Mora was stunned when he saw a pigeon at a Queens playground that had been painted a violet hue. The pigeon was taken Friday to licensed wildlife rehabilitator Bobby Hawrath. He says the bird couldn't fly because he had been painted. His feathers had been completely covered with paint. Well, you know, how can you rehabilitate a pigeon if it's actually a robot? You want proof pigeons are robots? Just watch the GoToMyPC commercials. They know what's going on, those people over at GoToMyPC.com. Just check out those commercials. By the way, over in Norway, they have knighted three giant pigeons. Actually, they're penguins, but, you know, kind of similar. Maybe these ones are robots, too. I don't know. You know, the giant spies from outer space. Ghost pigeons. Yeah. Sue, 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number, and Ted in Los Angeles, California is on the line. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hey, you know, activists who tend to focus on one thing are easily accused of being so obsessed they're either called tree huggers, whale huggers, or I don't know if anybody's called somebody a fetus hugger, but when they are that obsessed with an issue, it should not be misunderstood that they are anti-human or anti-mother.
Right.
They are just bringing to our attention an issue that they feel strongly about and that helps to, or they wish to, show how respecting trees, respecting fetuses, respecting whales, respecting the environment all play into the same existence that we live in. I mean, it affects us all. We are one way or the other.
Exactly, and we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Thanks, Ted. I mean, we can be in favor of saving trees and saving humans. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Mark.
Hi, yes. That was an interesting conversation you had there with Ms. Bernard. Her comments on the science of global warming should be taken in the context that she's an attorney by training.
Right.
It would be similar to my deciding that I have a pain in my side and I go to a witch doctor to get it analyzed versus going to
a car mechanic.
Actual science background, right?
Yeah.
And it really bothers me that people on her side of the aisle apparently lack the judgment to differentiate between propaganda sources.
I don't think that that's the case. I can't speak for Michelle, and I don't want to kick her around when she's not here. So let's take this out of the context of Michelle Bernard. But my sense of it is that I have had people on the program in the past who I'm quite sure know that the science that they are proponents of, because they're scientists, they're close enough to it to actually know that they know that it's phony science,
right?
But they're very well paid. And the ability of people, I remember back, you know, 20, 25 years ago, we were living in Atlanta, and I was driving to work one day, and this news story came on about how the tobacco companies were fighting, you know, this was back when the tobacco litigations were first starting, and how they were saying, you know, that it's not addictive and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I just, you know, the world headquarters of one of the largest tobacco companies, RJR, is in Atlanta. And so I picked up my phone And I called the headquarters, and this poor woman who answered the phone, I look back on this in embarrassment, but this poor woman who answered the phone, you know, said, hello, you know, RJR or whatever, however they answered the phone. And I said, how can you look at yourself in the mirror knowing every day that you're going to go to work for a company that kills people? And she said, I'm just doing a job. I've got two kids in school. I got to pay for them to go to school. And it was like this, you know, splash of water in my face. You know, suddenly I realized she's a human being just like I am. And there's what we need to be doing is saying there are some things that are just sacrosanct. You know, it's like life is, you know, human life, you know, selling tobacco. Tobacco is the only product we sell in the entire world that when it's used as directed causes death. And with regard to science, we just need to say, you know, this is the science. I'm sorry, you know, and the phony science is just not going to stand.
Am I still on?
Yeah, you are, but we're just about out of time. Got a couple seconds here, Mark?
Yeah, I agree with everything he said, but it would be good if we had better education. So
yeah, well, see, that's the bottom line. If our schools and our institutions and our media, I mean, I would love to hear the media say, excuse me? I know that's coming from the oil company, not from real scientists.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Program 35 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Two major points. First, even if global warming isn't true, we need not forget about acid rain, lung disease, cancer, dying oceans, forests that are even a problem whether or not global warming is happening.
Right, all the consequence of burning fossil fuels.
So even if global warming is false, all the using too much fossil fuels is causing all these other problems.
Right.
And that is not debatable. Anyway, I wish you would not let your guests get away with things like saying these new energies. Solar energy is the oldest energy we have. The first buildings ever made by human beings were solar and geo energies. Bandelier cliff dwellings in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They were cooled in the winter. Well, they're cooled in the summer because of the earth, and they're warmed in the winter because of the sun.
Right. But it's a bit of a stretch, Jeff, to say that, you know, living in a cave is using solar energy.
Well, no, solar energy. It's on a cliff, and it gets warmed in the winter when the direct sun hits.
No, I mean, you know, point made, but it's not anything that's going to, that in and of itself isn't going to cause an entire civilization to go, oh, yeah, we need to adopt that right now.
But right now, we could provide cooling and heating for virtually every building on the planet, most buildings, most dwellings, by just using geoenergy. When you bring up the warmth from the earth, it's warmer than it needs to be, what just needs to be warmed up just a little bit in the winter, and it's cooler than the air we would get in the summertime, so we can use that for air conditioning. Add solar,
and we
do not need to use any type of fossil fuel for any heating.
Yeah, my friend Dennis Weaver, I wrote the foreword to his autobiography before he died. It's called All the World's a Stage. Lived in a house that was sort of half built into a hillside.
Yeah, I visited his house.
Yeah, it was made entirely out of recycled material. You've been there?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
and,
I know well.
Yeah, and it's you look at, you know, like all these cities in the Midwest that have been wiped out or really severely damaged by tornadoes, and you think, why don't they rebuild, you know, half underground?
And the thing is, you can do the northern half if you're in the northern hemisphere where it's totally underground. The southern half is all windows, so it's a totally sunny house. It's not dark at all.
Yeah.
And you can get almost virtually all your heating energy from the sun and from the earth. You know, heating and cooling.
Yeah, and no, in Vermont, when we were, I've told the story too many times probably, but in the late 80s, we were traveling around Vermont looking for we moved from Atlanta to, or in, I guess it was the 90s, moved from Atlanta up to Vermont, and there were all these solar houses that were built during the Jimmy Carter era when there were tax credits to do it, and quite a few of them actually were built into hillsides. And, you know, you'd have sod roofs, you know, and you just have this whole wall of glass looking out of the side of the hill. And it's really kind of cool.
And they can be built modern. They can be made very quaint. And it's the thing is, with solar.
Yes?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were cutting me off. With solar, one thing we all need to realize, people keep forgetting, solar is not just electric. There are other types of solar technologies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, the main thing that solar is mostly available for, and every building on the planet is heated by the sun.
Jeff, are you you're right. Are you a delegate, by the way? Are you going to be at the convention?
No, not this time. I'm actually going to be out of the country.
Oh, okay. Well, that's unfortunate. I was hoping we could meet. I'll be there. I'll be on Radio Row. So to our listeners.
The day you're getting here.
Yeah. Well, to our listeners in Denver, drop by. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along here, but thank you for the shout out. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Yeah. How you doing, Tom? You know, what Michelle brought up, the so-called global or dimming effect, it's well known. In the 1970s, some scientists, and I have a Science Year article here that talks about that a little bit. They thought that the Earth was cooling due to the sulfuric acid in the area. It formed this soot. It came from sulfur dioxide produced by, obviously, fossil fuel production.
Right.
But what they found is, with further study, even if you allowed that acid rain and soot to stay in the air, you know, the so-called albedo effect, you still would be overcome from the greenhouse gas in itself. You'd still have a warmer planet. And also, with new laws, a lot of that soot got taken away. So that argument, it's an old argument, and it doesn't apply.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tim. And in fact, the albedo effect, the reflectivity of pollution, reducing the amount of solar radiation hitting the Earth, is a big cause for concern right now. You know, they noticed after 9/11, when there was no vapor contrails from all the jets, that there was a slight increase in solar radiation hitting the Earth. We've seen in the United States, as we've cleaned up our air, we've seen this increase in solar radiation. The big question is, if China were to suddenly clean up their air, if India were, if all the industrial world were to suddenly clean up their air, global warming might actually even kick into higher gear faster, because we would get rid of more reflectivity. And so it's like, how do we deal with that? I mean, you got people talking about putting sunscreens in outer space, or putting micro aluminum particles or zinc particles in with jet fuel to make the contrails stay in place so that they'll reflect more sunlight. I mean, it all gets very strange. Manson in Monroe, Washington. You want to disagree with me, Manson? What's up?
Yes, Tom. You know, Tom, I enjoy your program. But you know, this carbon dioxide theory and greenhouse gases, I think, is totally false. I've taught chemistry a lot of years. And the density of gases is directly proportional to their molecular weight, not so liquids or solids. Now, if you look at the density of gases, hydrogen is very light, lifting power, helium very light. If you look at water vapor, it makes all of our greenhouse gases. That makes the clouds. Carbon dioxide weighs 44. I've worked with it in the lab. It goes downward. You can generate it, pour it down a trough, and snap a candle right out at the bottom in just a couple of seconds. It's the only gas that produces all of our food and all of the everything that grows.
Yeah, I'll give you, Manson, that water vapor is a significant greenhouse gas, and one of the consequences of global warming is that there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, because the warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor. But what does molecular weight have to do with the ability of a gas to reflect or absorb carbon ultraviolet radiation or infrared radiation, really?
Well, as far as cloud cover, cloud cover is a greenhouse gas.
No, what does molecular weight have to do with the ability to transmit or reflect infrared radiation?
Well,
nothing.
The density of the gas is that it's down on the Earth and not up above. Have you ever heard anyone give the percentage of carbon dioxide up there and noticed any change in percentage? You never give that. They just say greenhouse gases. Now, carbon dioxide is the photosynthesis gas. It's got to be down where grass is.
It's everywhere. I mean, it's distributed throughout our atmosphere. Carbon dioxide, you know, most of the atmosphere is nitrogen, you know, which
right.
is, you know, if you want to talk molecular weight, nitrogen
78% is... 78% nitrogen, 30,
Right, and nitrogen is heavy. The forms of nitrogen you're finding in the atmosphere are slightly heavier than carbon dioxide, are they not? Well, add up the molecular weights.
No. Nitrogen weighs 428.
No, but it's...
Oxygen weighs 32, carbon dioxide 44.
Right.
At the same temperature and pressure, you can look at the density of the gases. Same
but none of them exist as pure gases in the atmosphere. They all exist as atoms combined with other atoms to form molecules.
Well, nitrogen is N2. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right, it's two
oxygen,
atoms.
Oxygen is O2, 32. Nitrogen is N2, 28. It's 78% nitrogen,
yeah.
21% oxygen.
So
let me ask one question.
Manson, maybe I'm missing your point. Are you saying that because carbon dioxide has a higher molecular weight that it all has settled to the surface and there's none of it in the upper atmosphere? Is that your point?
Right. That is right. Now, if you look at all that algae over in China, did you see them hauling all that algae away?
Yeah.
Well, massive amounts. What's happening is photosynthesis is absorbing...
No, what's happening is enormous amounts of fertilizer are being poured into the rivers, and that fertilizer, because of intensive factory farming, and that fertilizer is feeding the algae, and you've got these algae growths, and this is why we have over 400... Manson, thanks a lot for the call. This is why we have over 400 now dead zones around the world. They have been doubling every decade since the 1960s, and it's got a lot of scientists very alarmed that these massive dead zones in the ocean are maybe the thing that are going to take us out. Maybe the things that are going to take us out. Don in Sonoma, California. Hey, Don.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show.
Thank you.
Just want to call your attention to an article that's in the new July 2008 Discover magazine. It's an investigative report, what's happening to our oceans. It's one of the scariest things I've ever read in my life. Even the scientists who are quoted in this article are scared to death.
They are, because this is the basis of our food chain. And and the oceans are becoming so acidic that forms of life that require exoskeletons, an external calcium-based skeleton, can't live in them, and which sounds like bad news for crabs and lobsters, but it's really bad news for the microscopic forms of life that have exoskeletons that form most, like krill, for example, if they form the basis of the food chain that is eaten by the smallest of fish as well as by whales, and that are the foundation of life in the oceans.
Yeah.
It's we're killing off the foundation of life in the oceans. And as we do that, the oceans provide about a third of all the oxygen to the planet, and we're not to mention, all this enormous amount of food. All the big fish species, that we find 90% of them are gone. We've overfished to the point where, it's back in the... Thanks, Don, for the call. I mean, I remember Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips, right? North Atlantic cod. You can't get North Atlantic cod anymore. In part, the company went out of business because the fisheries were crashing and the cost of the fish went through the roof. And now it's like, well, let's farm the stuff. And then you get all these fish with fish lice, and they start contaminating the wild fish.
An historic time for America. Live, on-site coverage of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Strange times. You've heard of thieves. You've heard of thieves breaking into homes to steal jewelry, TVs, collectibles.
Baby, take off your shoes.
Well, in this case, a woman came home to find a real mess in her laundry room, went upstairs to call her absent husband.
Baby, take off your dress.
When she reached to the phone,
yes.
A stranger appeared from nowhere, giving her the fright of her life. Yeah, well, he left his hat on. Not only was the man an intruder, but he was half naked, wearing only a pair of blue boxer shorts. The streaking crook came upstairs from the basement, grabbed the woman's purse, and bolted out the door. Cops believe he simply needed a place to wash his clothes and broke a window to get inside. This woman chased this guy, forcing him to drop the purse and its contents, which she recovered. So despite his doing his laundry, it wasn't quite a clean getaway. The guy got away without his clothes. Ellen Ratter with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for the real news of the day. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the president is he's in Texas. He's going to be going to speak at the VFW convention. Then he's going to New Orleans and Gulfport, Mississippi. And he's apparently they have arranged some way to allow Louisiana, depending on your perspective, 30 years to repay the state share of the hurricane protection construction for the levees, et cetera.
Hmm.
I guess that's pretty good news.
Yeah.
This morning that supposedly the Russian president signed a ceasefire agreement committing Russia to the end of the hostilities. Well, at the briefing today in Texas, Gordon Jonroe said that the Russians are beginning their withdrawal, and yes, they have apparently also heard reports that they have not done that.
Right.
And then there's this question of whether the Pentagon, or actually it didn't come, I think, directly, sort of indirectly from the Pentagon, that SS-21 missiles are being moved into parts of Georgia by the Russians.
Right.
And the White House would only say that they're not going to comment specifically on what Russian units or equipment are there, but if it rolled in after August 6th, it needs to roll out. They said that would be in keeping with the Russians' commitment of withdrawal. But in other words, that sort of leaves it iffy if they were placed there before August 6th.
Yeah. The whole issue of I'm looking for the story here that I had. Over in the Asia Times, actually, there was a fascinating piece about how the Russian people are looking at the situation. And their perception of Shakhavili is, and Medvedev really, kind of laid it out this morning. He says, you move against us and our people and we will crush you. And their perception of Shakhavili is that he's no small D Democrat. They view him as the same kind
of
essentially.
They definitely see him as an aggressor.
Well, they see him politically. They see him as a phony, as an autocrat, much like Putin is. I mean, in fact, this is the quote from the Asian Times this morning. In Georgia, Russian leaders see a regime that controls the economy and public life. It uses the image of an external enemy to consolidate power. When President Mikhail Saakashvili subdued the only independent TV channel, Emeti, which, by the way, was owned by Rupert Murdoch, still is. He took a leaf from Putin's book in 2001 to 2003. Shakhavili went even further. He used the army to disperse opposition rallies. When Putin looks at Saakashvili, it's like looking in the mirror. The image is the same, but younger, from a time when Putin was just building his power base during his first term. This is probably why he hates Saakashvili so very much. The reflection is not very flattering. And then they talk, there's just a fascinating piece in the Asia Times about how the Russian politicians are playing chess. And America is playing Monopoly, that what we're trying to do is get, we're trying to get as much money as together as possible, whereas the Russians are playing literally for an end game. And in fact, Spengler, the commentator, he says the most dangerous thing here is that the Russians are underestimating the stupidity of the West. He says the fact is that all Russian politicians are clever. The stupid ones are dead. By contrast, America and its complacency promotes dullards. And a deadly miscommunication arises from this asymmetry. The Russians cannot believe that the Americans are as stupid as they look and concludes that Washington wants to destroy them. This is what the informed Russian public believes as well, and these perceptions are very dangerous. They've now got into Skingali, the capital of South Ossetia, and it looks like there actually are thousands of casualties there as a result of the Georgian invasion.
Apparently, Condoleezza Rice made a comment either today or yesterday saying that we will find out what the Russians did. She said the world will soon know what the Russians did and how they did it. And a lot of people think that that is a reference to ethnic cleansing. And then, of course, Lithuania and Poland came out and said that the Russians are carrying out ethnic cleansing.
Right.
So apparently Russia has filed a complaint.
Russia's making the same case, though, against the Georgians.
Right.
You know, they're saying the exact same thing. They're saying that the Georgians, you know, wanted to drive ethnic Russians out of South Ossetia, and that...
But what's interesting is that Condoleezza Rice is making this comment.
Yeah.
And then Jandro responds today, well, we've had reports from both sides, and you have to look up charges from both sides here.
Yeah. Well, but see, last night on CNN, you know, the commentator did this summary piece on the whole thing, and he said, and then, words to the effect of, and then Georgia involved itself in South Ossetia, and the Russians responded by invading Georgia. He didn't use the word, the phrase that the Saakashvili and Georgians invaded South Ossetia. He said, you know, involved. And it's like we're getting just half the story here.
Well, we are
States.
Getting just half the story, but as in any case, you got to be up front. It's just kind of like Iraq.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thanks for dropping by, Ellen. Good talking to you. 58 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Alan Weisman. What would the planet be like if all the humans did die off?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
What would the planet be like if we were all gone? What happens to the Earth when humans disappear? Alan Weisman has written a thoughtful and thought-provoking book, The World Without Us, a New York Times bestseller. And he's on the line with us right now. Alan, welcome to the show. Alan?
Yes, thank you.
Hey, great to have you with us. This is absolutely an extraordinary book, and not just the conclusions that you draw, but the case that you build, the science of it, and the look at you know previous civilizations, how you know the Pleistocene overkill theory, the kind of we've been there befores. Let's start at the beginning, or with the biggest of the big pictures, which is what would happen to the planet if humans say there was an Ebola and the flu virus met each other, and suddenly there were just no humans left on the planet.
Well, you know, I used a premise like that. It's highly unlikely that we would all disappear right away, but that I intentionally chose that because. So many environmental books don't get read because people are scared. Oh, my God, what if we all die? In my book, everybody's already dead. It happened very quickly, but everything else is left to continue on. And the first thing that would happen is that things would get kind of quiet because just imagine when the last time was that you didn't hear any motor sounds, any sounds of a human fired engine. Suddenly we would just hear wind, rain, insects, birds. It would be really rather lovely. And all of those things would start to invade our spaces very quickly. It happens right now. Engineers who maintain bridges in Manhattan, for example, showed me that whenever their back is turned, a sea will lodge between two plates, steel plates and germinate, and suddenly roots will be pushing them apart. Well, there'd be no maintenance people left to fix that sort of thing. Under New York City, which is one of the examples I used in the book, all the pumps that constantly are emptying the subway tunnels of water, groundwater that's trying to fill them up, would cease to run, so it would be flooded within 2 or 3 days, and that would start to corrode the columns that are holding up the streets, and they would start to collapse within a couple of decades, and we'd have rivers running on the surface of Manhattan, which is what we had, 150 or so years ago before they flattened down the city to superimpose a grid of streets on top of it. Also, all these plants and animals would confront things that we would leave behind, things ranging from those buildings and our infrastructure to materials, some of which are quite resistant, like plastic or some of our radioactive wastes. And they would have to deal with them. They'd have to deal with the fact that for the next few hundred years, corrosion would release chemicals from chemical plants or dry cleaners or whatever into the ecosystem. And then, of course, there's all this carbon that we have dug up out of the earth, pumped into the atmosphere. It would take a while for that to be reabsorbed.
But it eventually would.
It eventually would. Scientists who I interviewed for this, and this was a couple years ago, thought it would take about 100,000 years for all the industrial age carbon dioxide to eventually get reabsorbed. But the good news is that most of that would happen in the first 1,000 years, actually the first few centuries. So there's every good reason to start now to diminish or to abolish the amount of carbon that we are adding.
Well, I've seen estimates that, you know, the oil, most of the oil that we're using today was created during the Carboniferous period, this 300 to 500 million year ago time.
Well, certainly the coal was. You know, the creation of oil is really still kind of mysterious. And we know that small sea creatures were probably compressed to form it, but we know much better how coal was formed, because you can still go down there and you can see the grain of tree trunks metamorphosed into coal in coal mines.
Right.
Plastic experts who I interviewed for this explained to me that the original tree trunks, you know, they were made out of lignin and cellulose like trees today, but microbes had not developed any enzymes to break down lignin. They'd never seen it before. So for the first 100,000 years or so, trees, when they die, they would just sort of lie there. They wouldn't decay, but they'd get covered by silt, and eventually so much silt buried them and compressed them, and that's why we have coal today. And that's what's going to happen to a lot of our plastics, because until microbes learn how to digest the stuff, it's pretty indestructible. So you can just imagine the telephone that you and I are talking on, or computers or Barbie dolls entering the fossil record.
Yeah, yeah, over the short term anyway. But I've heard it said that in 1 year we burned through an amount of carbon that took, I've heard numbers as low as 100,000 years and as high as a million years, for the planet to accumulate out of the atmosphere and stash under the earth, basically through mostly biological activity, photosynthesis capturing it, and then the fossilization process, and so that would be reversed.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, nature has always existed in sort of a mass and energy balance. It used the amount of energy that it needed, and what it didn't need, it's just stored away,
right.
You know, it buried it. And we were part of that cycle. We started to accelerate it when we learned how to manage fire, and then eventually we started to melt rocks, first accidentally. Some copper started to flow around a campfire, and we realized, oh, look what happens. And then we entered, you know, a Bronze Age, and then an Iron Age, and then finally an Industrial Age, where we learned how to do all kinds of things if only we had concentrated energy. So we dug up energy millions of years worth that nature had stored away, and we've used it up in the last 200-300, and that's why there's a million years worth of concentrated energy waste products floating around in the atmosphere right now that unfortunately are changing things on us.
We're talking to Alan Weisman. He is a columnist, the author of 5 books, senior editor and producer for Homelands Productions. WorldWithoutUs.com is the website. The World Without Us is his book. And Alan, what was the point of writing this book?
Well, the point was not that I want human beings to disappear. I mean, you know, some people have asked, you know, what, do you hate people? Do you think that we are a pox on the planet? And by no means. I think that we deserve to be here as much as any other species. But there's no question that too much of any good thing can be too much, and our presence has become so overwhelming that we're starting to push other things off the planet that ultimately going to eliminate us too, because we depend on lots of other species to do lots of our work, you know, purifying our water, pollinating our plants, all sorts of things that happens in the ecological web. But it's really so hard for us to think about that huge ecological web of all those other species, because we are so dominant and we're also so interesting that our presence literally distracts us from really looking at the planet to see how it functions.
As a species, we're total narcissists.
Well, but I think every species is a total narcissist, so I can't blame us for that.
What
I realized was that if I theoretically just cleared humans off the planet, we could see much more easily what else lives here, how it would perform without all of our daily pressures, how it would deal with all the junk we leave behind, which is another way of looking at what it is that we're doing every day.
Right.
And then when we see how magnificently nature could restore itself, which is what I discovered time and time again through all my research all over the world, even if it can't bring back an extinct species, it can come up with something else that will take its place. Nature's always done that. Then the conclusion that I hope that readers take away from this, and which seems to be the case, is, wow, if nature could do that and it could happen so quickly, there's got to be a way that we can still be a part of this, only in harmony with the rest of the planet and
Alan,
not in constant combat with
it. We have about a half a minute left. The carrying capacity of the planet before we started using ancient sunlight, oil and coal, was never greater than a half a billion people. What do you think is the appropriate, and now we're pushing 7 billion, what do you think is the appropriate carrying, what is the appropriate human load on this planet?
Well, I don't think anybody knows for sure. You know, we know that at the beginning of the 20th century, before all the agricultural technology and medical technology caused a population explosion, the population doubled twice in the last century, we were at 1.6 billion. If we all tried the Chinese experiment, which granted has its downsides, which have been revealed to us, and it's important to understand that. But if everybody had only one child from now on, within a century, we'd be back to 1.6 billion, and there'd be a lot more room for other species to exist.
Right. And perhaps for us. I mean, it's not like the world was lightly populated in 1900.
Exactly.
So,
well,
Alan Weissman, his book, The World Without Us, the website also, theworldwithoutus.com.
At worldwithoutus.com.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, worldwithoutus.com. And the book has the in it, but not the website. Alan, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 17 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Heroes of Labor, Joe Hill. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. Stuart Acuff is with us. He is the assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO and AFL-CIO.org, the website. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you, as always.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I should note, you've been a community organizer and a union organizer for over 30 years. The Employee Free Choice Act. Our program, in fact, is sponsored in part by the Teamsters fighting
right.
past the Employee Free Choice Act. We're very, very proud to have the Teamsters, Teamster.org, as a sponsor of the show. The Employee Free Choice Act has got corporate America quaking in its boots to the point that Walmart is dragging their employees in for special. It almost sounds like, you know, what the Soviet Union used to do, or, you know, Mao Zedong, you know, re-education right. sessions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a little bit scary when you think that corporate America would go so far as to try to intimidate or manipulate its workers into who to vote for in this election. It's blatantly illegal. It's a violation of federal election law. But corporate America is afraid of giving average, everyday working Americans the free right to choose for themselves whether or not to join or form a union. and bargain collectively. And this act, as you know, Tom, is the most important thing that's happened in the labor movement for 70 years since the passage of the Wagner Act.
Yep.
Because it would restore the absolute right of most working Americans to decide for themselves whether or not to be in a union.
Yeah, then the next thing we have to do is repeal...
Taft-Hartley.
I was going to say there's...
You're exactly right.
I've got a long list, but that's at the top of it.
You're exactly right, and you're ahead of us on that, Tom, but you're exactly right. Repeal of Taft-Hartley would do a great... would go a long, long way towards restoring balance in our economy.
And it's amazing how that thing got passed through Congress in 47 over Harry Truman's veto.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's just the Republicans had power, you know, and in both the House and Senate, and boy, did they use it. I mean, the Democrats really have some lessons to learn in the use of power, I think.
Yes, we do. We certainly do.
In any case, I just have to tell you, we're talking with Stuart Acuff, the assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org is the website. Of course, here in Portland, Oregon, and I was in Seattle over the weekend. We saw the same thing on TV in Seattle Saturday night. I'm assuming that my listeners, in fact, I hear from my listeners all over the country, that they're seeing the same thing. It is local advertising more often than not, so it doesn't get any kind of national attention. It's not being discussed. But you can't watch an hour of television, particularly on cable, in this community, without seeing one of about a dozen variations on the theme of the big labor bosses want to take away your right to a private vote.
Yep.
Gordon Smith, our Republican senator from Oregon, who is running for re-election and is running scared every 6 years, this is his second time. He did the same thing last time. He votes Republican 90 to 100% of the time. His voting with Bush record in the 5 years running up to this election was about 95%. It was right there with George Bush all the time. And then in the last year, he starts going against Bush. He's running ads about how he joined with John Kerry for this. He joined with Barack Obama for that. I mean, he's literally in his own voice with his own face saying, I joined with John Kerry to stand up for it. I joined with Barack Obama. He's running. But then his campaign is running these ads about how his opponent does not want to allow you to have a secret vote for a union. And therefore, I mean, just really, really trashing his opponent.
And an outright lie, Tom. I mean, there is nothing in the Employee Free Choice Act that will outlaw or do away with workers being able to petition for an election and getting an election. They could still do this under this act, still do that under the act. And that is, both methods of forming a union are legal today, either signing cards or petitioning for an election and having an election.
Right.
Today, the employer gets to decide. Under this act, it's the workers who will decide the method of choosing a union.
Right, but they are, I mean, they must be spending hundreds of millions of dollars nationwide in the
$100 million this year, $200 million next year to stop this. And they're being very smart. They're running these ads to make their money go as far as possible. They're running these ads in the 10 to 15 targeted Senate races around the country. So Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine, Colorado, New Mexico, Oregon are seeing a lot of these things. But
Stuart, we just have like 20 seconds. How do we push back against this?
Well, number one, they're in these. Number one and most important, vote Democrat, vote Barack Obama. Tell people that we need to restore balance in the economy and workers need a free choice about whether or not to be in a union. Support the Employee Free Choice Act and listen to Tom Hartman every day on Air America.
And keep in mind, if you want democracy, you want a union because a union is democracy in the workplace.
Tom, you're a great friend. We appreciate everything you do every day.
Thank you. Stuart Acuff, AFLCIO.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at
866-303-2270.
25 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And downright crazy stuff going on. I got two stories for you from Russia. The first, a crazy one. The other, a serious one. This is the verdict of a judge in Russia last month, dismissing the case brought by a 22-year-old woman in the advertising industry who was claiming sexual harassment. She said that her boss had told all his female underlings to, quote, signal with their eyes if they desperately wanted to be laid on the boardroom table. She hadn't realized that he meant this literally, and this is from Lucy Kellaway's column in the Financial Times. She hadn't realized that he meant this literally, and her eyes may have given an inadvertent twitch at some point. When she refused his subsequent and most unwelcome advances, he locked her out of the office. The judge ruled he was appropriate in firing her. The judge said sexual harassment is a good thing. The human race would die out without it. Yeah. Well, it's a difference between civilized and uncivilized. Here's the serious one, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. But this is from today's Financial Times, and I encourage you to track this story down. Catherine Belton writing in today's Financial Times. The library in Svengali, this is the capital of South Ossetia. The library in Svengali is charred and pockmarked. House after house on the city's main streets have been hit by rocket fire. And on Telman Street, a residential Jewish quarter just a few hundred yards from the city center, nearly every home has been reduced to rubble. In Svengali, few residents doubt that the government in Tbilisi, that's Georgia, that's Saakashvili, in Tbilisi began the battle for the city when the Georgian army launched a volley of rocket fire shortly before midnight on August 7th. And they talk about how the entire city, this is quoting Muma Sekmanvili, one of the few Georgians still living in this ethnic Ossetian-dominated capital, said, the entire city was leveled centimeter by centimeter. We were 2.5 days in a bunker without food. By the end, there were more than 100 people in the bunker with us. Dead people lay there. It was a living hell. Researchers, this is quoting from Financial Times. Researchers at Human Rights Watch say initial evidence indicates most of the damage resulted from Georgian rockets. Russian officials deny bombing the town and are holding the city up as a key symbol in a campaign to accuse Mikhail Saakashvili, the pro-Western Georgian leader, of ethnic cleansing in launching an attack on Svengali just hours after declaring a ceasefire. Once it gained control of the city last week, the Kremlin began organizing trips for journalists from North Ossetia into South Ossetia capital and surrounds. They talk about the people there. They were initially helpless in the face of Grad rockets, the Soviet-era missiles used widely by the Georgians. In Svengali, the air in the villages filled with the smell of rotting corpses. They quote Yuliana Kasieva. Now, there's a dispute about whether, you know, how much of this damage was caused by the initial attack by the Georgians and how much of it was caused by the Russians, fighting back. And that dispute is probably not going to be resolved very quickly. But she says they were shelling us from all sides, and this was the response. She says, why did Saakashvili do this? Why did they bomb my city just because I'm an Ossetian? They promised us they would not fire, and then they attacked the city. Mikhail Mensayev, the head of South Ossetia's interior ministry, said this week that the death toll had hit more than 2,100. He says, we are still finding the remains of people. We are sometimes finding whole families in basements. All that's left of them is bones. Their family can't recognize them. You will find none of this in the American press. We are playing this in the United States as if Georgia never started this thing, didn't initiate this, didn't cause all these deaths, and the response from Russia just came out of the blue. And I think, frankly, we're making a big mistake. And our press is making a big mistake, and our government is making a big mistake by not letting the American people know that there are two sides to this story. Neither side is probably right. The Russian response was, I would say, almost certainly a massive overreaction. On the other hand, the Georgian, Saakashvili had a ceasefire, and then he starts dropping bombs on people at midnight. It's just not the way to do it. Just not the way to do it. So, anyhow, got a bunch of folks here, been on hold for a while. Rita in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Rita.
Hi. Yes. I was thinking about trying to get into to that preacher down there, the mega church meeting. And on a Friday afternoon, and I listen to your this station and public radio station, so I think I heard it on them later in the afternoon Friday, that they were charging $2,000 a ticket to get into that debate.
Wow.
That's what you want to call it.
That would account for why
the
crowd kind of
warmed
to John McCain saying $5 million is what makes you rich.
Yeah, mega church. There you go.
Yeah, amazing.
And on BBC America, when this started about Ossetia, it was they were showing for two nights running, even BBC was doing it, not only the news hour, and that followed up on it on TV. They were showing people in the bomb shelters, and they were acting like they were it was in Georgia that it was happening, not in Ossetia. And those people were in the shelters there for two nights running, they did that.
Right. Yeah. I you know, whether they were confused or not, I think not.
They were confused the second and third night they were doing it.
Yeah,
and they barely mentioned it the third night.
Yep. And as I said, last night on CNN, I mean, the guy didn't even mention the Georgian invasion of South Ossetia.
Right.
They were
confused because they were shown the same picture of the same family coming out of the bomb shelter three nights in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. I mean, it's like, who is being served by this? Clearly, the military-industrial complex makes a fortune if we have another Cold War. They would love us to have another Cold War. John in Phoenix, you want to disagree with me? John, thanks for waiting so long.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Just sort of ask you about your claim that Democrats don't lie.
No, I wouldn't make that as an absolute statement. Certainly, you know, politicians in general tend to lie. My point was that the Republican agenda for the United States is that conservatives, by and large, the true conservatives, classic conservatives, I mean, go back and read Russell Kirk's 1954 book, which is still the Bible of the modern conservative movement, the conservative mind.
Are you going to let me ask my question?
Yeah, but I thought you mischaracterized what I said.
I quoted what you said.
Okay, go ahead and ask your question.
Well, when Obama promised to take public financing for the presidential election, would you classify that as a lie?
I don't know that he unilaterally promised that. I thought it was a qualified statement.
He put it in writing. Okay, how about
the statement in writing was qualified as well.
How about this? Democrats claim all the time that Republicans morphed Max Cleland's image into Osama bin Laden. You've heard that claim before, haven't you?
I don't recall.
Yeah, well, you've actually made it yourself. And you've made some statements about Don Siegelman's about Canary prosecuting Don Siegelman, and she recused herself. And you know, I would say you're just misinformed. I wouldn't call you a liar. But
I have seen the ads.
Would you say
with Max
lying?
Cleland and Osama bin Laden? Yeah,
you've seen him. You've seen his face morphed into Osama bin Laden.
Well, perhaps it's the wrong word, but
he doesn't even appear in the same frame. That's my point. Is these stories that you weave and get out there in the public. I mean, you talk about Republicans, Tom. You are such a serial exaggerator. It's getting into crisis mode.
So you've gone back over what? I mean, last time I talked about Max Cleland was a year ago.
Well, no, I just talked to you about Mrs. Canary, and you talk about that all
Laura
the time.
Laura Canary did initiate the prosecution of Don Siegelman.
No, she recused herself before any indictments or anything happened to them. You didn't even use
but
the word.
But she initiated the prosecution.
You said that she was she prosecuted him.
I would say initiating a prosecution is prosecuting somebody.
Have you ever said that she recused herself?
Don Siegelman has said it on our program.
What does that
have to do with anything, John? Here you have the wife of the campaign manager of your opponent initiating a prosecution against you, and you're defending that, John?
She didn't initiate the prosecution. That's where you're wrong. You need to look these things up. And by the way, speaking of Don Siegelman, do you know he's been on television and the radio 30 times since he got out of prison? And he has not been able to come forth. I mean, Dan Abrams won't even let him on his show anymore. He's so embarrassed by him. He can't even state one scintilla of evidence to back up his claim about Karl Rove. No, not that.
John, the Republican talking points are so... See, this is why Republicans have to do this. Republicans have to do this because their agenda for America is rule by the few and rule by the rich, period. Get rid of the unions so working people can't stand it. Take down people by any means possible. Have the wife of the campaign manager of the opponent is the federal prosecutor, is involved in prosecuting. And I believe Don Siegelman when he said it, and I've read the articles, and yes, putting in the same campaign ad, Max Cleland and Osama bin Laden, when the guy running against him is this fool who got a series of deferments from the Vietnam War and then ran as a war hero, or essentially ran as Max Cleland, was not sufficiently patriotic. I mean, come on, give me a break. It is astounding to me, the level to which the Republican apologists and sitting on hold for an hour and a half. You know, what are you being paid? $50 an hour to do this? I mean, it's incredible. Plan on seeing a lot more of this kind of thing coming up. This is the Republican machine at its
Air place. America makes history. Live broadcasts and continuing coverage from the DNC in Denver on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
I should take it as a compliment. You know, it should be considered high flattery. Probably because we're the number one rated progressive talk show in the United States. That somebody with either a lot of money or a lot of time has been going through years of archives of our show. And, I mean, it's been a long time since I've talked about Saxby Chambliss. Here's the ad, by the way. This is Saxby Chambliss. Ran against Max Cleland in 2002 in Georgia. Max Cleland used to be my senator when I lived in Atlanta. And Max Cleland left three limbs in Vietnam. He lost both legs and, as I recall, his left arm and in Vietnam. And this Chambliss ad starts out, the visual on the starting out of this thing is a picture in the upper left-hand corner of Osama bin Laden, in the lower right-hand corner of what looks like Saddam Hussein, actually. I'm not sure who it is. And then there's a couple of fighter bombers and whatnot. Here's the spot.
As America faces terrorists and extremist dictators, Max Cleland...
Now, they immediately switch then from the face of Osama bin Laden to the face of Max Cleland in the same black and white format. And there's his picture.
...television ads claiming he has the courage to lead. He says he supports President Bush at every opportunity, but that's not the truth.
Well, actually, he's supported the national security.
Since July, Max Cleland has voted against the president's vital homeland security efforts 11 times. Max Cleland says he has the courage to lead, but the record proves Max Cleland is just misleading.
And then at the end, pass
America...
by the Saxby Chambliss Committee. And this was the ad that the argument was made that even though the week before and the day before the election, the pre-election polls all showed in Georgia that Max Cleland was going to win by 2, 3, 4, 5 points. And Chambliss won by the exact percentage that Cleland was predicted to have won. And the exit polls the day after showed that Cleland won. And this was the first time in the history of Georgia, 2002, that all of the votes were done on electronic voting machines, and there was absolutely no paper trail in the state. And I still believe that Max Cleland had this election stolen from him. But it's been years since I said that ad morphed Osama bin Laden's face into that of Saxby Chambliss. And I would say, you know, for all practical purposes, it does. You play them back to back, the effect is the same. But it's just remarkable. I love it. Oh, my. Joe in Denver. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Fine.
Good. Well, first of all, just before I forget, I wanted to ask you a quick question, and then I'll make my comment and take your response off the air. I'm trying to find tickets for your debate that you're going to be doing with, was it Dennis Krieger on the 25th in Denver?
And yeah, you know, that was put together by and is being handled by the folks over at Air America. And I don't know if the local station is involved. You might call the Denver affiliate and ask them.
Yeah, they're not, and so I'll have to look at Air America.
Okay,
there's nothing on your website either.
Louise says that we'll have information on our website up in 24 hours.
Okay, perfect. Well, anyway, the other comment that I kind of wanted to make was just a little bit in reference to something you had mentioned earlier just about Barack Obama. And I guess I understand you're a Democrat and you're a supporter of the party, but as I continue to see Obama continue to edge and kneel closer and closer to what would the majority of people's perception to be the middle of the road as far as politics go, I'm just wondering, I mean, when do you make a vote on principle rather than based on the party, and when do you, I mean, if you continue to support these individuals who go back, you know, like on the FISA bill, or as much as I hate to admit it, the other caller had a point about Obama saying that he was going to rely primarily on public funds, and then turned around and did something else. And I'll probably end up voting for Barack Obama myself as well.
Yeah.
But just wondering what your opinion is on when you change and you vote on principle, and if that's the case, when will be your breaking point?
Well, first of all, I don't consider myself exclusively a Democrat. I say on this program, and I've said it many times, we need to take back the Democratic Party. But I'm also a Green. I also strongly support the Green Party. And particularly at the local level, the Green Party's gotten over 300 and some odd, 350, something like that, communities to have instant runoff voting, which is something that both the Democratic and Republican parties fight against every chance that they have. And I voted Democratic in the last election, but in 2000 I voted for Ralph Nader, and I lived in Vermont, I did it because I wanted the Green Party to get that threshold of where they could get federal matching funds in the future. That said, I think it's really important that we have a Democrat in the White House. I mean, having John McCain or any Republican in the White House right now at this point in time is going to be really destructive to this country. These guys for 30 years have been taking apart America. Ronald Reagan declared war on working people in America when he busted PATCO, and then he turned the Labor Department into an anti-labor force. They have been systematically taking apart the middle class and for what they think is a very good and honorable reason. That a strong middle class leads to, in their mind, leads to instability. You get students rioting. I mean, look at the 60s and 70s. You had people, you had African Americans rioting in the streets. You had students rioting in the streets. You had women burning bras. I mean, oh my God, this is society melting down. That's the conservative worldview. And they, like with John Adams, they just think, hey, it's the rabble. It's too much power in the hands of the people. So there's got to be this autocracy that's basically running the show. And that's, but see, because the majority of Americans don't agree with that, that's not their worldview, they don't go along with the Republican perspective. The only way that the Republicans can win office is by either A, lying about these things, or B, taking wedge issues, small, peripheral, largely irrelevant issues, God, gays, guns, abortion, things like this, and inflating them to be more important than the possibility of the biosphere melting down or war or the middle class disappearing. And, up to this point, tragically, they've been successful. I mean, it's really a startling thing. Tomorrow, Renee, Marie, Stefano, and Dan Gaynor will be with us. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.